This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And, you know, I'm just kind of spitballing here. What if we sent the folks in Washington, all the shutdown, debt ceiling, brinksmanship folks in Washington, down to Antarctica to huddle together like penguins in the freezing cold and try to survive? How quickly might they come up with a deal to restart the government then? Just a thought. Again, spitballing. Later this hour, we're going to actually spend some time with an adventurer who talks about what the penguins can teach us humans about sticking together and making it through adversity. We also have a remarkable tale. We'll focus on a novel in the voices of disabled people struggling for freedom. That's later this hour. A funny, non-preachy portrait of oppression in America, poverty, and health care. That's also an unforgettable story. But on day 9 of the Washington, D.C. federal government shutdown, here's where we stand.
In a government shutdown, millions of Americans face inconvenience or outright hardship. In an economic shutdown, every American could see their 401ks and home values fall, borrowing costs for mortgages and student loans rise, and there would be a significant risk of a very deep recession.
Great. President Obama speaking yesterday, and yes, we heard from the Republicans as well. Here's Speaker of the House John Boehner.
What the president said today was, if there's unconditional surrender by Republicans, he'll sit down and talk to us. That's not the way our government works.
The way the government works. That's pretty rich to hear from the speaker this week. In any case, Stephen King joins us. He's HSBC chief economist. He's author of When the Money Runs Out, The End of Western Affluence. Stephen King, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi, how are you?
Great. What's really interesting about talking with you is that you write that, in fact, all of this political talk in Washington and this little tempest in a teapot going on under the Capitol Dome is actually an indication of something much, much bigger. That the deck chairs are being kind of rearranged on the Titanic of Western affluence, and that what we're really seeing is the end of the kinds of wealth and the assumptions that we've made in the industrial West, Europe, and the United States for a century now. Really?
Unfortunately, yes. It might not sound like a very cheerful story, but we've been accustomed over the last 50 years or so, maybe 60 years or so, to assume that our economies continue to expand at a rapid pace. And that assumption worked very, very well up until the end of the 20th century. But for the last 13 years or so importantly, even before the onset of the global financial crisis, economies have expanded at a much slower pace. Now, that in itself is fine because we're still getting slightly better off more slowly than was the case previously. But the difficulty is that we have made promises to ourselves in the past based on the continuation of the old growth rates. But now with these new, much lower growth rates, it's more difficult to meet those promises. And those promises range from things like entitlements, pensions, healthcare, education, through to promises within the financial system, like the relationship between people who lend money and people who borrow money. And all those things have become a lot more difficult over the course of the last few years.
And those conflicts are ratcheted up, and so the rhetoric that we're seeing really bespeaks the difficulty of working out the math and in the midst of this declining set of expectations as much as anything. You said it's not a cheerful story. I should say nobody ever looks to people named Stephen King for cheerful stories. I'm talking with Stephen D. King, chief economist at HSBC. So is this an opportunity for the Chinese and for the East Asians to really go, you know what? Let's get out from under these assumptions about the West and accelerate our attempt to jettison ourselves from the debt cycle in the United States.
Well, that certainly has been a big theme over the last few years as a consequence of the rise of China, the rise of East Asia. And actually, I think one of the problems that's come through is that their success has reflected in things like much higher energy prices, much higher metals prices, much higher food prices. And their success also is a reflection of the fact that global investment is much more mobile. So, you know, companies that may have invested in the States or in Europe in the past now can choose to invest in much cheaper labor markets in East Asia. And the consequence of this is that although the global economic pie has got bigger over the last few years, Asia's share and the emerging market share has gone up really quite rapidly, even as the U.S. and Europe have struggled to grow as quickly as they had done in the past.
So even though the Republicans and the president can try to reassure Americans that it's okay, we'll dodge this bullet, we'll get through the deadline, it's not going to be an apocalypse, we'll bounce back and everything will be the same. In fact, you're saying the opposite is the case, that this signal in Washington basically says the end is coming. It may be fine in a couple of months, but it's not going to be the same, right?
That's absolutely right. There's a degree of wishful thinking that takes place amongst the political classes. They always assume that somehow the economy will rebound to the growth rates of old. And that assumption has been wrong now for 13 or 14 years in a row. It's what I call sometimes the theological option that politicians pray for a strong recovery. Unfortunately, their prayers haven't really been answered. And it's that growing gap between economic reality and political promise that's becoming ever more challenging year by year.
And the Chinese wealth, the Saudi wealth, fossil fuel wealth, emerging markets aren't going to bail out the U.S. economy in the form of purchasing exports.
Well, the problem is that even if U.S. exports go up to those countries, it's also the case that U.S. wages are coming down or being pressurized downwards as a consequence of outsourcing and offshoring to those countries. So there are winners and losers within the U.S., but overall, I think the performance of the economy has not been as strong as one might have expected, given the dynamics of China and other parts of the emerging world. So, yes, it's a struggle.
Stephen D. King is chief economist at HSBC. He's the author of When the Money Runs Out, The End of Western Affluence. And, you know, we'll call on you again whenever we need a cheerful story, Stephen King.
Thank you.
So from the macro to the micro of the debt ceiling shutdown controversy, talk about wealth running out. Well, that is the daily experience right now of Marcelo Del Canto, a budget analyst for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's an administration within the Department of Health and Human Services. I asked Marcelo how he's been filling his days since he last walked away from his desk on September 30th.
Well, I've tried to be as active as I can with this whole furlough thing. So I've been downtown several times. I've been at a couple of news conferences, at a couple of rallies. There's another one tomorrow. So I'm trying to stay as active as possible, getting in front of the senators and congressmen and letting them know the pain that we're all feeling is a very real pain. And we're not just a bunch of numbers that they're easy to talk about on TV, but not experiencing the pain that we're experiencing.
What is not getting done as a result of you not being in the office? And I understand your wife is also at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. I suspect her duties also unmet at this moment.
Correct. So on my end, I'm a budget analyst. So what I was doing up until the furlough was making sure that our fiscal year closed out correctly, making sure that all the grants and contracts that we fund, which is in the billions of dollars, which provide the services to the mentally ill and substance abuse disorder folks throughout the country, millions of folks that receive those services directly or indirectly through SAMHSA, that funding is in place so that they can, in fact, operate. So that's obviously not happening now. And on my wife's end, she's a public health analyst, so she gives technical support and provides support to all of the grantees that do receive the federal funds in order to operate these programs that provide those services. So that's just a snapshot of the two very important things that are not being done right now.
There are people out there, there are clinics out there that are shutting down because the money that you disperse isn't getting there, and those individuals are pretty much cut loose by the federal government.
I would assume, yes.
Now, what about you and your family? You're not getting a paycheck. You've got your own personal issues.
It's a very hard pill to swallow because I've said many, many times, I'm a budget analyst and I pride myself on running a very tight budget at home. And this is not something that one could ever really plan for or budget for. You know, you can have savings and so on and so forth. But what do you do when neither you nor your spouse has any income? That's a very difficult, if not impossible, situation to plan for.
Do you have televisions, flat screen TVs in your home?
Oh, yeah.
And do they all have cracks in them from throwing pots and pans at them if you happen to turn to a news channel?
No, I haven't gotten to that point yet. Like I've said, I've tried to be active, getting down to the rallies and getting with the senators and congressmen and having them hear the message. And just a lot of things to do around the house, you know, reseeding the lot and so on and so forth, trying to keep myself busy and my four-year-old from staying out of trouble.
What do you tell him about why mommy and daddy are both home from work?
You know, we had that discussion early on last week when we stopped taking him to daycare because it was obviously one of the biggest expenses besides our mortgage that we knew we would have trouble meeting. And we basically sat him down and said, mommy and daddy are not going to take you to school for a little while because we're not working. And then he said, oh, so I'll stay home with you. And I said, yes. And he was fine for the first couple of days. But this week has been a little bit tough because he's so used to being at school with his friends and his teacher. And he keeps asking when he's going to see his teacher again. And I said, honey, I can't tell you when. I really don't know.
And the House and the Congress have passed this bill, which at least in theory will pay retroactively when the government starts up again. You're familiar with that legislation that went through?
Yeah, it passed the House. It hasn't gone through on the Senate, but the first and foremost is we have to get the government running again.
Well, I don't want to be too partisan here, but when Eric Cantor said we've passed the retroactive, so all the federal workers will get paid, I mean, it sounds like he's saying, so it's okay for us to yank your chain like this. What's your response?
Again, I think it's real easy to talk about something that one is not experiencing. You see a lot of the news channels saying, oh, well, 86% or whatever statistics they say of these agencies are still open, counting my own. And, you know, there's a handful of people working out of the 600 some employees at SAMHSA. And I would hardly say that we're open. So it's real tongue in cheek for them to say, well, you know, 86% of the agencies are open. Well, they're not really, because everyone pretty much is sitting home like myself and my wife. When you got the credit cards and the mortgage companies calling you as to asking you when you're going to pay, that's a tough conversation to have on a daily basis.
Marcelo Del Canto is a budget analyst for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, furloughed along with his wife because of the government shutdown. Marcelo, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
So what about you? Are you micro on all this or macro? Is it the end of Western affluence as we know it and the folks in Washington just whistling the funeral dirge? Or are you micro here, feeling the shutdown's effects directly in your family?
This is Amanda from Worcester, Massachusetts. My husband has been furloughed and there's no end in sight to the situation. There's certainly a feeling of hopelessness. He's worked for the government for 12 years and has put his heart and his soul into his work. For the last 4 years, he's gotten a cost of living increase, and on top of this, no paycheck. We need to consider bank loans to pay our bills if this lasts much longer.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story. Tell us what you know. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You know, even as the parade of mail, have you noticed that, Nobel Prize winners this week hits the headlines in the scientific community, you might say there's a deeper cultural shift slowly making itself felt in the world of science.
There are women in the academic administration. We've had a woman president. There are 2 to 3 times as many women faculty as there were. Young women who had no idea what ever happened, this all came about, take it, of course, for granted that all these things are the way the world is. The older women can't believe this happened in their lifetime, honestly. The ones who came from where I am are just thrilled with what happened. So, is everything fixed? Not yet.
That's MIT scientist, molecular biologist Nancy Hopkins talking about the successes that MIT has had in recruiting women into the sciences and onto its faculty and into the next generation of scientific research and future Nobels. And as she suggests, challenges do remain. MIT has already had a woman scientist president, Susan Hockfield, and scientists, women, are emerging in greater numbers in the life sciences and social sciences, but the laggards are the core of the so-called STEM fields, particularly physics and math. Eileen Pollack is now a professor of English at the University of Michigan, but she was one of the first two women to earn a Bachelor's of Science in Physics from Yale back in the 1970s. Her story is told in a recent profile of gender challenges in the sciences in our partner, the New York Times. Professor Pollack, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So you were turned away from something that you definitely loved back in the 1970s. Looking back, how do you feel about all that?
Well, you know, I wasn't turned away, and that's the mystery. I would have always told you I walked away. I was sort of ashamed of having come so far, gone so far, and then left the field. And I think the takeaway is that a lot of people think women are choosing not to go into the sciences or math or choosing to walk away perhaps at some point to stay home with their children, and that it's not really a choice in the sense that you don't realize how much you're putting up with that maybe the guy in the next seat is not, although it's a difficult field, I think, for anybody of any gender. There's so much in the culture or in the way women are raised, in your own psychology, in the images you're receiving. For example, I remember – so with the Nobels being announced, I remember that in my quantum mechanics class, the inside covers of the book were all the physics Nobels back to the beginning of time, and seeing just the two women out of all those men – made a big impression on me. You know, I just didn't feel like I belonged or I fit in. Also, I had such a disadvantage. I wasn't allowed to take advanced science and math classes when I was in junior high and high school. So by the time I got to Yale, I was so far behind from the beginning that I was exhausted just catching up. And then I did overshoot the mark. I graduated at the top of my class, but I didn't feel that way. So I think that's the takeaway, is that and these recent studies, some of the ones I cited in the article, are that there is all this gender bias, even that women have against other women in the sciences, that people aren't acknowledging. And, you know, it's just that day-to-day feeling of putting up with so much more than you even know you're putting up with, that's keeping women out or causing them to drop out of the field.
One of my 15-year-old girls goes to a very science-oriented technical high school here in New York City, and mm-hmm. she has no sense that there's any sort of gender issue going on at all. I mean, she sort of is very competitive with guys at school. I mean, I think she understands about sexism. She's not naive in any sense, but she certainly comes free of the fetters that I understood were just really out there in the 1970s. What obstacles do you think she still faces if she wants to pursue a career in science, particularly the you know, physics and math area of the sciences?
Right. Great question, John. And I think what surprised me the most, so when I started writing my book, it was just going to be my own sad story from the 70s. And then I thought, well, let me check to see what's changed. And I went back to my junior high, my high school, and to Yale. And I was shocked, especially at Yale, how the women were saying the same, even though there were more of them, young women, undergraduates, who seemed so confident. And you would, like your daughter, you would think they didn't face what I faced. And in some ways, their stories were worse, because I think there's just a much stronger emphasis on sort of traditional notions of femininity, feminine appearance, these fancy weddings that wasn't even true in the 70s. So these girls were still saying to me they didn't think a boy would date them if they said they were a physics major mm-hmm. or a math major. I think at many high schools that girls who aren't as lucky as your daughter attend, I was shocked at how many young women were still telling me that their high school teachers were teasing them, saying, you don't belong here, girls can't do physics, or saying things like, you're too pretty to be, you don't look like you would be good in physics because you're too pretty, guidance counselors steering the girls away from the science and math courses. So there's still a lot of that.
Is there also an issue within the sciences that it is kind of a priesthood, in the sense that it has its own language, its own sort of fraternity, and there's a communal quality that makes it hard to impart those values outside of a group that's so oriented in a particular way. The sciences themselves come with this problem.
Yeah, although it's not so much communal as it can be a very isolating sort of endeavor. And I think that gets to many people of both genders, but especially women as they're working through. I want to say, too, that even your daughter is going to face – there are just in our society, in the culture, the image of the scientist is still male. As a male nerd, you know, I talk in the article about the Big Bang Theory. Very funny show, but the men on that and the few women – are portrayed as just so socially clueless and unattractive and, you know, unappealing in so many ways.
And my daughter has definitely
picked
up on that.
Who would want to, with either gender, exactly. You know, gender be one of those?
Eileen Pollack is an English professor at the University of Michigan. She's also the author of the New York Times Magazine article, Why Are There Still So Few Women in Science? Good question. If you have any answers, reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Professor Pollack, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
A milestone for women in finance, but perhaps a detail lost in the maelstrom of Washington politics. Janet Yellen is now President Obama's official choice for chairman of the Federal Reserve to replace Ben Bernanke when his term expires early next year. She would be the first woman to run the Fed. Yellen is currently the number two at the Fed. She's apparently the second choice of President Obama after Larry Summers withdrew his name earlier this year. But her expertise in executing and understanding the current Fed policies may be a real asset in projecting to the world that the Fed, at least, plans to stay the course in U.S. monetary policy. Joining us now is Elizabeth Duke. Ms. Duke is a former Federal Reserve governor who joined the board following President Bush's nomination in 2008 and served until August of this year. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Lots to talk about here, but let's just begin with the obvious question. Who would want this job now?
It's a tough job, but I think Janet has probably spent her whole life preparing for this job, so she may be one of the few people who would want it.
And even given the situation with the debt ceiling, in that all of the quantitative easing, the idea of being able to hold Treasury auctions, the Fed's involvement in all of that seems very precarious because of what's going on Capitol Hill?
Well, Janet has, you know, she's up to speed. She knows all of the pieces. And she's been doing this for most of her life, most of her career anyway.
Does an individual who runs the Fed right now in this moment need to be a shrewd political operator, or is it enough that the person has a legendary reputation, as Janet Yellen does, as a sophisticated student of monetary policy?
Well, as you know, the Fed is politically independent, which is important to its ability to do its job. So her knowledge of the tools of the Fed, how to use them, and her knowledge of the economy are certainly her most important assets.
What do you think the message is from President Obama to the financial world and the buyers of U.S. debt? Is it we're moving on? Janet Yellen reassures the international markets, we're trying to get beyond this sort of thing. Can a single appointment do something like that?
You know, what it definitely says is that we're serious about the Federal Reserve and we're going to put someone in charge that absolutely knows how it works.
In terms of the Board of Governors, does the current situation on Capitol Hill produce turmoil or is there clarity? And would she be basically running a ship that doesn't have a lot of division and difference of opinion regarding the way forward?
There are always a lot of different opinions in the Federal Reserve and in the FOMC boardrooms, but she's experienced at dealing with all of those different opinions. And you know, the job of the chairman is to bring the group to consensus and to find a position forward. So I think she'll be very good at that.
And the fact that she's the first woman, what does that say within the financial community? What does that say to you personally? Is this overdue, right on time?
Well, you know, I'm always glad to see very capable, talented women in positions of authority, but I think her being a woman is the least of her, you know, incredible qualifications. She has numerous qualifications, and I would point out that for a number of years, when I was on the board, there were three women and two men.
And what about the confirmation hearing? Would this be an opportunity to rehash monetary policy, or do you think the current controversy means that this will get waved through? The last thing they need is instability at the Fed right now in Washington.
You know, confirmation process is always full of surprises, but I think she's certainly well prepared to go through that. I think, you know, the Senate will take it seriously, and hopefully it'll be a fairly quick confirmation. I think that would be a great outcome.
Elizabeth Duke, former Federal Reserve governor who served from 2008 until August of this year. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And in our further explorations of shutdowns around our great nation, we arrive at some labor disputes that are silencing the music for some great U.S. orchestras and cultural institutions. A few examples: the 110-year-old Minnesota Orchestra locked out in a labor dispute that has threatened this year's season. Last Tuesday, their conductor, Osmo Vanska, resigned 2 years before his contract was set to expire. Last week, Carnegie Hall's opening night had to be canceled after a year-long labor dispute with stagehands failed to be resolved. The New York City Opera, shut down by its own heavy debt ceiling, will be closing its doors later this month after 70 years. Can content or music itself reverse the fortunes of the classical music world? Howard Herring is an innovator in the face of the shutdown shadows for cultural institutions, president and CEO of the New World Symphony in Miami, an orchestra known for challenging audiences with this. And also seducing audiences with this. CEO of the New World Symphony, Howard Herring, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be here, John.
Wanted to give people a flavor for what you're doing. Can you really bring young audiences and fight fiscal problems with content, with music itself?
We are doing that. We're very proud of the work that we've done. We've been at this for 5 years. We're coming to a marking point. We're beginning to understand these new audiences, how we've attracted them, how we've engaged them, and how we are bringing them back.
What are you putting on stage that really changes the experience of going to a symphony concert? You've done some remarkable things.
Great playing is the center of all this activity, but it is surrounded by experience, by experiences that are expansive, that are invitations to these new audiences, some of them younger, many of them more diverse. So it's how you put the music in the center of a larger experience, and that is the power of what we're doing.
Let me try to get tangible here. I know where the violins sit, I know where the flutes are, I know where the timpani sits.
Sure.
Where does the DJ sit in the orchestra there at the New World Symphony?
So when we do our Pulse late night at the New World Symphony, we are inside a flexible performance hall, and the seats, the first seven rows of seats, are moved back, and the audience floods in and stands directly in front of the orchestra.
You know what we call that, right?
Pardon?
You know what we call that.
What do you call it?
The rave pit.
That is the rave pit. I think of it as where the groundlings are in Shakespearean theater.
That's right. Exactly. The Shakespearean theater was this very populist experience.
Absolutely. Direct connection, comments back and forth. It's very real and it's very different. But the DJ is on the far side of the stage, and then the stage is opposite that DJ in the hall.
All right. So the violinists in the audience are saying, well, he talks a good game, but what are the numbers here? What are you actually paying people to do this kind of thing?
There are 1,600 tickets that we sell to a Pulse event. People go and come. It's a 750-seat hall, so obviously people are moving in and out throughout the evening. They're not only sitting. They're dancing. They are talking with our players. They're having a drink. They're socializing with their friends, socializing with people that they meet. They're guiding their own experience. 47% of this audience is new to our database. Median age, 38. It identifies as almost half non-white. So it is a young, diverse audience.
And a pass-through to other more traditional concerts of the New World Symphony?
When we began this project, now 5 years ago, we thought that we would bring people in for 30-minute performances and then 60-minute performances and then long forms. We have discarded that idea. We see this as a neural network. We see people coming to the shows that are engaging them at a high level. They will move around that network long term, and they will become part of an audience that is ours.
Are you a player, Howard Herring?
I'm a pianist.
Pianist?
In my deep, dark past.
Wow, with a great gig.
For sure.
Howard Herring, president and CEO of the New World Symphony, attracting new audiences with music like this. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Como el correr de las arenas en el Sahara, libre como el sol de Chadelas, gacelas, o como el churumeru en Venezuela. Libre, libre, al fin soy libre. Soy el hijo del viento.
It seems the penguins of Antarctica didn't get the government shutdown message last month. Listen, they're acting as if nothing is wrong, as if the situation is completely normal. But the U.S. government shutdown is causing facilities to consider maybe packing up for the year down in Antarctica. The U.S. National Science Foundation has stopped paying defense contractor Lockheed Martin, and it's running out of funds for its research operations at McMurdo Station at the South Pole, threatening an entire season of experiments. For a skeleton team at the Antarctic facility, it may mean even more extreme isolation and patience than is normal for people working near the South Pole. A few years ago, adventurer and medical doctor Gavin Francis volunteered to serve as the on-base physician for the very isolated British Antarctic installation called Halley, located along the Caird Coast on the Brunt Ice Shelf beneath the Theron Mountains that few humans have ever seen. He stayed for a year, feeling the isolation, experiencing the beauty, and discovering some things about himself. The story of his experiences is told in the book Empire Antarctica, and he joins us from very temperate Milano, Italy. Gavin Francis, welcome to the program.
Hello, John. Thanks for having me on.
Do you miss Antarctica, even today?
I do miss it. I mean, Antarctica is the purest, stillest, most beautifully elemental landscape on Earth. The contrasts with the life that I have now in Europe are immense. So, yes, I do miss it.
And how do you contrast the beauty with the sense of isolation, of being on your own, even if you are with a small band of people gathered in little warm cubicles trying to keep out the elements?
The isolation, for me, is part of the great beauty of it. For 10 months of the year, our base was isolated, and I was told that as the physician there, I would have no opportunity to evacuate any medical casualties for those 10 months. And that level of isolation gives it some edge, I think, some extra special atmosphere that for me made it all the more enjoyable.
Part of what you write about is how you fit in your own small way in the huge historical narrative of the exploration of the Antarctic. Did you feel as though you were standing on the shoulders of giants, that you were part of the same adventure, or is it all pretty much cut and dry in the 21st century?
No, I felt very much that we're leading on from this tradition, from the heroic age exploration, people like Scott Shackleton, your own Admiral Byrd. Admiral Byrd's book is one of my favourite stories of Antarctic exploration. And the way we live now in the Antarctic is very much because those guys in the early days left us a legacy. They keep us safe.
So you arrived in the Antarctic on a boat named for the explorer Shackleton, right?
Yeah, the RRS Ernest Shackleton, yeah.
The Shackleton legacy, I imagine, would be a fairly terrifying legacy. I mean, did you feel a little bit like you were heading into the same sense of doom that Shackleton experienced?
No, well, as a physician, my role model really was Scots physician, a guy called Edward Wilson, who was a magnificent guy, a polymath, a naturalist. Shackleton himself was a master of managing people and difficult situations, and undoubtedly learned from him, yeah. But I wanted to learn a little bit, too, from the physicians.
Give me a sense of the visual expanse from those mountains that were behind the Halley Station to the ice shelf that you actually lived upon, and then, of course, the coastal area there, that ocean that stretched out in front of you.
Well, there's a little video your listeners can see on my website. It's just www.gavinfrancis.com. Go and have a look at that little video, and you can see something of that pure expanse, that binary world that's only made up of ice and sky, and of course the penguins, the emperor penguins. The base where we were huddled on the edge of the ice shelf had one of the largest colonies of emperor penguins on the Antarctic continent, and I spent a lot of time sitting with those penguins.
And those penguins exposed to the elements and you bundled up in a parka, could you imagine what they were going through?
Well, you know, their lives, their minds are very simple. Their lives are impossibly difficult for us to imagine. They fast for 4 months, through 4 months of total darkness through the winter. And I couldn't imagine that. But those 4 months of darkness through the Antarctic winter were also some of the most beautiful. You know, the sky is filled with auroras, meteor showers, wheel of the constellations above you in the sky. I had a sense of that sort of the depth and beauty of the world that they live in. Of course, their lives are so much more dangerous than mine could ever have been there. But being able to sit with them through the winter, I had something of the sense, yes, of how they live.
What did the penguins teach you about the importance of even us humans huddling together on this planet?
Well, penguins have only survived here. They're the emperor penguins are the only species to survive that far south year round. And they have this immense capacity for tolerance, for stillness, for endurance of the most appalling conditions. And so they were a real inspiration to me. They were representative, too, of the community of the living off there over the northern horizon. And so they reminded me that I was still part of this world of life which was going on in the north, even though the continent itself felt dead.
And when today your Mediterranean wife complains about the cold, can you have any sympathy for her whatsoever, or are you an intolerable bastard about the whole thing?
Yeah, I do sometimes, especially with my children. She wants to get their jackets on and their scarves, and I say, come on, you need to harden them up a bit.
Gavin Francis, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A little farther north, all this week you've been letting us know how you're feeling the effects of the government shutdown. My husband works for the federal prison system, says one of you from Florida, and has been informed that even though they have to report to work, they may not be paid. So right now it's a wait and see case. Close to the capital itself, Bethesda, Maryland, my husband has to go to work every day and not get paid. And if he takes any leave whatsoever, he will forfeit back pay for the entire shutdown. There's a miserable story. Share yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us at Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Just text the word START to 69866 and you can get the jump on all our conversations. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
The disabled are kind of a convenient metaphor for the movies and storytellers, little puddles of misery and misfortune, or childlike little god creatures full of wisdom. The million-dollar baby, paralyzed, poignantly begging Clint Eastwood for death.
I can't be like this, Frankie. Not after what I've done. I've seen the world. Let him keep taking it away from me.
Or there's Forrest Gump, a Yoda of mental retardation, perfect wisdom absolute good.
Hey, dummy! Are you retarded or just plain stupid?
No, I'm Forrest Gump.
Just run away, Forrest.
Run, Forrest! Run away! Hurry!
These are not the characters who inhabit a brilliant novel and a groundbreaking piece of art that is all about the reality of disability. Good Kings and Bad Kings, a novel by Susan Nussbaum, is a heroic story about a group of disabled people and the people who work with them in a care facility in Illinois. The title comes from a line delivered by a particularly cruel worker who revels in the powerlessness of his disabled wards. Nussbaum, a skilled playwright, disability activist, and a quadriplegic herself for decades from a spinal cord injury accident, wrote this novel in first-person voices for each of the characters, whom she unflinchingly calls Crips. The impact is vivid, authentic, really funny, and the little nursing home that could story in this book emerges big, emotional, fresh, and as you're about to hear, Susan Nussbaum successfully turns disability into a much more powerful metaphor for this world's struggles with oppression and intolerance.
Although it's a book on a certain level that's about how disabled people are segregated into institutions and how horribly backward that whole way of thinking is and how it's what victims of the bottom line disabled people are. And it's a huge issue for the disability rights movement. So it was important, I think, on that level to talk about it from the disability world and from that perspective. But yeah, I do see that there are modes of oppression that impact people all over the world that are parallel to this kind of thing or different variations on the same old story.
The first person piece of this is, you know, on one level, you know, it reminds you of other styles of novel writing, but there's a point in here where somebody delivers a first-person account of their own demise that is utterly heartbreaking. And I have to say, in terms of novel writing, way out there. Did you always know that, and I don't want to give everything away, but that would be sort of the center of this novel? Did you know how that's how he would end?
No, I don't believe I do. But I did know there was going to be an ending for someone. And I didn't feel that it was appropriate for anyone else to tell about it. I thought it was, or to, you know, be in the room and watching and talking about it from their living experience. I thought it seemed natural to me that a person who was dying would at the last moments be aware of it and be able to let us, the omniscient reader, in on what was going on.
This book is out in paperback a little later this year. It's been out in hardcover. What responses have you gotten from people within the disability community about the quality of the voices, the authenticity of the voices, the sense of that idea of empowerment and overcoming that vulnerability?
Well, the feedback I get is really good and really encouraging. And I was a little worried about it, you know, because it is something that goes to the core of what the disability rights movement is concerned with. And also this whole notion of representing disabled characters in a way that departs from what we're used to seeing in novels and in movies and, well, by fiction writers in general as the disabled voice, which is, of course, as you know, could not be further from our reality. You know, we have these movies, for example, something that people see from birth. There are even cartoon versions of adult disabled characters where the character is mostly concerned with being cured or how they're going to get killed off at the end or the experience of being institutionalized. Those are the ways that these disabled characters are resolved in fiction. And I needed to respond to my own anger at movies like Million Dollar Baby and Forrest Gump, etc., by writing some other characters.
And in terms of a critique of healthcare in America right now, you know, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act and this insanity that's going on in Washington right now. Do you think the questions and the indictment that you make of healthcare in this book as a part of the story, not in a preachy way, but it's certainly in there, is a part of that debate?
Sure. Absolutely. I think that the profit motive is the core piece of every single thing that we see going on in the healthcare system. It's the most mercenary system, along, of course, with the prison system. But in terms of the mass piles of money that is made off of the ill health of our citizens, it's such an important right. And in this country, of course, it's been said many times, it's not a right, it's a privilege.
And in the healthcare system that's depicted in this book, people are denied their humanity. It becomes an innovation to have a company that deals with them as commodities. And yet, in the end, their voices come through. Their humanity triumphs. Happy ending?
In a way. Oh, I think it's an ending with hope. You know, some of the characters don't make it. But I think that there is always hope. And we have to believe that the humanity in all of us will triumph on some level, maybe slowly and unevenly, and maybe in just these completely unpredictable ways. But we've got to evolve. Because the situation really does stink for too many people.
Susan Nussbaum, Chicago playwright, disability advocate, author of Good Kings, Bad Kings, out very soon in paperback. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Oh, the places we've been this hour. Thanks for being with us. And from you, a lot of sympathy for furloughed federal workers, we heard. And also from some of you, not so much.
My name is Michael from Miami, Florida. I really don't see any problem with the government shutdown. In essence, it might be a great thing. Being that they're closed down, they're not spending more of our money.
Is that a responsible approach to the shutdown? We'll take that up tomorrow with Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear. A reminder, our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.